I've already been talking for quite a while this evening, so I won't go on for too long, but I just wanted to speak a little bit before we finish today about a little bit more about the ceremony we've just done, in particular about the actual nitty-gritty of the basic ceremony, which is the homage to the Buddha, the triple gem, the refuge in the triple gem, and the eight precepts. Of course, this being a very standard formula for ceremonies as done in the Theravadan tradition, and the precepts be given either most commonly, of course, the five precepts, or the eight precepts, or the ten precepts for the novice ordination in a very similar kind of form. It's a very standard ceremony. It's done constantly in most Theravadan centers and monasteries and so on. You may have noticed since being here that we tend to not do the five precept chanting as often as is done in many places, and the reason for that is that in my opinion that particular chant has degenerated to become just a mere form, and when people take the five precepts in traditional Buddhist ceremonies, almost always they never have the sincere aspiration to actually keep the precepts. And so I don't think that that's very good. So when we do the chanting, instead we do the three refuges, so that's something which I think that people can generally identify with and generally feel a sort of a heart connection with. I'll do the five precepts or eight precepts if requested to, rather than doing it formulaically at every major event, which is often done. So. This chanting is part of a central ritual or central affirmation as done by the Theravadan community, which defines the nature and the content of the Theravadan community, especially the lay community. And so one of the advantages of this is that in all the Theravadan countries and traditions, it's always done in Pali. So even though there is a good arguments for translating the Dhamma and for doing Dhamma teachings and ceremonies in one's own language, of course the disadvantage of doing that is that the forms and traditions will tend to separate and to splinter, and there'll be less ability for each tradition to understand each other. As we see today when the Chinese do their rituals in Chinese, the Vietnamese do them in Vietnamese, Koreans in Korean, and so on, even though they have essentially the same religious background. Whereas in the Theravadan tradition, while there are many cultural differences, at least the chanting done in Sri Lankan temples, Thai temples, Burmese temples, Lao temples and Cambodian temples, will tend to be pretty much the same. There's some variations in the pronunciation and some in the details of the chanting, but pretty much the chants done are similar. And so when you learn these, and as you move around the Theravadan world and participate with the community in different centers, you'll always be able to feel at home and to be able to be part of the community. So this is one of the reasons why keeping things in Pali is kind of nice. I like it. So when we chant these things, the first chant is the Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa, of course the homage to the Buddha, and mentions the Buddha in three aspects, is the Bhagava, the Araha, and the Sammasambuddha. And the Bhagava is a word which is difficult to translate exactly into English. But what it really means is something like, I think that the basic meaning of it is something like someone who's a source of bounty. It's translated as the Blessed One, which I think is a reasonably good translation. It's a very high honorific in English in Indian languages, and used not just of any monk or something like that, but used only of very exalted figures. So you can read in the Visuddhimagga, it has a sort of extensive description of the different implied meanings of Bhagava, but this is what I the main meanings that it has for me is the meaning of once is one aspect of it, a meaning is something like a meaning of a lord in the sense of being someone who is very very high in a high position, but also somebody who's very bounteous and full of blessings and of wonderful qualities which are shared with everyone. This for me is the meaning of Bhagava. The Araha is the, of course, the Arahant, and the basic meaning of Arahant is somebody who is worthy. And so the Arahant is a name for the perfected individual in Indian religions, not just a Buddhist term, but generally speaking in Indian religions. And so there's this notion that through one's own practice and one's own effort, that one becomes worthy. And so the applied or symbolic meanings of arahas, it's given in the etymologies, it says something like that one is also far from defilements, or that one is the destroyer of one's enemies, the enemy of course being the defilements as well. And these kinds of meanings, they're not strictly etymologically accurate, but they do point to that meaning of the Arahant as somebody who has arrived at that state of worthiness through their own internal process of overcoming their own defilements. And then the last epithet of the Sammasambuddha, of course, is the perfectly awakened one, and referring to the essential nature of the spiritual goal according to Buddhism is wisdom, awakening, one's own inner perception of the truth. And so the Buddha has been able to see and perceive the truth for himself. Now these three terms are equated in the tradition with the three dominant qualities of the Buddha. The Bhagava is associated with the Buddha's compassion, the Araha with the Buddha's purity, and the Sammasambuddha with the Buddha's wisdom. So all of these are different aspects of the Buddha. So in saying this phrase of Namo Tassa, and has this homage, this aspect of homage, and this word namo is very important and found all through the Indic traditions again. And again, it has this idea of that one is humbling oneself in the face of or in front of that which is of highest spiritual value. And so in this case is the idea of the Buddha, as someone's humbling oneself to. And Ajahn Mun made the sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek kind of pun in saying like everything in Buddhism starts with namo as homage, but in Buddhism really everything starts with mano, which is of course the mind in the first verse of the Dhammapada, Manopubhangama Dhamma. Mind is a forerunner of all things, all dhammas. And so he did this kind of pun of switching around namo to mean mano, which of course has no linguistic basis, but is quite clever punning. And so he points out that in Buddhism, it's always our intention that guides the course of our spiritual practice. Wherever we start from is where we're intending, where our mind is going to be leading us to. And so if we have in that intention, that attitude of namo, that attitude of homage and respect for that which is highest, for that notion of Buddhahood, the Buddha's purity, his wisdom and his compassion, then our life will be well directed. So the second part of the ceremony which we do is the going for refuge, and notice how this particular aspect of the refuge is, it's an active form. It's gacchami, oneself is going to. It's not something which you're asking for, and it's a very different kind of attitude between Buddhism and most of the theistic religions, where you would not so much be saying, I'm going for refuge, it's a present indicative tense, this is what I'm doing. But instead you would say, Lord, may you protect me. And so you're asking, beseeching for help from above. So the Buddhist attitude is, no, this is what I'm doing. It's one's own personal choice, one's own personal responsibility. And the refuge is, of course, the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And the Buddha is the historical figure, Siddhartha Gautama, born in India roughly 2,500 years ago, who was born in an upper-class family in the Sakyan clan in the grove of Lumbini. His mother was Maya. He was taken back to his hometown of Kapilavastu, where shortly afterwards Maya passed away. He was brought up by his father, Siddhodana, and his foster mother, Mahapajapati. And later in his life, he married a lady whose name we don't really know, if we're going to be completely honest about it, and had a son called Rahula. And at the age of 29, he went forth, spent 6 years studying with various teachers and philosophers in India, doing various ascetic practices, and then at the age of 35, under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, realized awakening. After he realized awakening, he traveled to Benares, where he taught the group of five ascetics, teaching on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path. He then returned to the Rajagaha region, gave various other teachings to the ascetics and lay people in the area, gathered a following, a sangha, established monastic community of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, established many monasteries, gave many teachings, and then many years later, 45 years later, at the age of 80, together with his beloved attendant Ananda, and accompanied by the sangha and worshipped by many lay people, he passed away in the sal tree grove in Kusinara. That's what we know of the Buddha. That's his life story. And when we take homage to the Buddha, there's a sense which I think is preserved strongly in the Theravadan tradition and less strongly in the Mahayana tradition, that there's an actual historical person who lies at the basis of this. So we can give this notion of Buddhahood various kind of metaphorical or spiritual meanings. We can treat Buddhahood as an archetype, which certainly has some meaning and some relevance. I don't want to dismiss that at all. But it's important that we also remember that there's an actual historical person. It's not just an idea. And remember that Buddhism is an actually historically grounded religion. It talks about, at the essence, at the basis, it talks about certain facts of history, things that actually happened. And there was an actual human being with blood in his veins, with dirt in his feet, who, after washing his feet, sat down on a grass mat under a tree, investigated his own mind, and realized awakening. So that, to me, is something that's very profound. And I, as you know, it's been an important part of my own life and my own spiritual practice to try to dig underneath the layers of symbolism and legend and accretion to try to find out, well, who was the Buddha? Again, not from a perspective of trying to dismiss the importance of the symbolism around it, because I also think that has its own validity and its own sphere. But I don't want to displace the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and just turn him into purely a symbolic archetype. So this is the Buddha as a refuge. Now, the Buddha, when he was living, he taught. He didn't just go into seclusion and enjoy his meditation, which he was tempted to do after his enlightenment. He thought, well, I could go out there and teach and get all kinds of students and disciples, and boy, wouldn't that be a hassle. Everyone's coming to me and telling me their problems. I can really live without that. Maybe I should just go away and do some quiet meditation in a cave somewhere. And so luckily for us, he didn't do that. And he came and taught the Dhamma. And he did that for a period of 45 years. And I do find it to be a very remarkable feature of the Buddhist tradition, and I think universally of every Buddhist tradition, both monastics and laity in Theravada and Mahayana, that they seem to be almost completely ignorant and unconcerned as to what the Buddha actually taught. And it's in fact rare to the point of vanishing to find anybody in the entire Buddhist world who actually takes the question of what the Buddha taught seriously and who actually does something about trying to figure out what that might have been. Recently I've been reading and looking a little bit at the life of King Mongkut in Thailand, and of course before he was the king he was a bhikkhu, and this was a very important question for him, and he could see the same thing. He was very dissatisfied with what he saw taught around him as Buddhism, and made a very serious and dedicated inquiry into the Buddha's texts to try to figure out exactly what the Buddha taught and what he didn't teach, and used his own not only textual studies but also his own wisdom and discernment to be able to sort out what that might have been. Now, that is very unusual. There's very few monks, very few nuns, very few lay people who take that kind of thing seriously. And of those few people in the world, I want you to be among them. And I want people in this monastery to also be part of that search. I want you also to take this question very seriously. And when we say we take refuge in the Dhamma, we don't just do that in a vague sense of, well, that was a nice thing to say, and so that's Dhamma, and that's why I take refuge in it. I want you to take this very seriously, that there was a real historical Buddha who actually taught things, and that what he actually taught was meaningful and relevant and is essential to understanding and progressing with our spiritual life. And I want you to take the time and the trouble and the effort to find out for yourselves what those things are. Now, I'll be offering some guidance and some encouragement in that direction, but I don't have all the answers. There's certain areas that I've studied in some detail. There's many areas that I have not. There's many things where maybe I can clarify certain areas of confusion or uncertainty in what the Buddha may have taught or may not have taught. There may be other areas where I can add to the confusion and unclarity by all my mistakes. So this is why I need other people to not to take me on my word, but to look at what the texts say themselves, apply them in their own life, listen to them in the context, how they're understood by the traditions. So this notion of looking for the Dhamma and the real teaching of Buddhism shouldn't be done in a way that's disrespectful of later traditions. Okay, so we accept that it's not always the case that later traditions accurately remembered and passed down what the Buddha said. They made mistakes, they went in wrong directions, and so we need to identify them. But that doesn't mean, as is sometimes assumed, and I think quite often assumed, that the later traditions are nothing more than a completely unnecessary waste of time. I find this an incredibly implausible and disrespectful way of relating to a tradition, to think that in 2,500 years nobody has had anything worthwhile to say about the Dhamma, and yet in effect that's how it's treated by many people and monastics. And this is something that came up for me some time ago when I had made some discussion of the influence that Jataka stories, particularly the attitudes towards women in some of the Jataka stories, had made an influence on the life and the attitudes of Buddhist communities. And I was heavily criticized by one Western monk who said, you know, how can you say this when you know that we never read any post-canonical literature? I find that an astonishing thing to say. You know, that the Western, according to this Western monk, was basically saying that among the community of Western monks, that nobody effectively reads the post-canonical Buddhist literature. I find this an extraordinary thing. And I find an incredible attitude of disrespect to simply ignore everything they have to say, and to thereby imagine, because you're ignoring it, that therefore you're not influenced by it. Of course we are influenced by it, because the ideas found in those scriptures make their way into the Buddhist community in all kinds of ways. They inform the language and the ideas and the attitudes of people within that Buddhist community. And so it's by reading and understanding these texts that we understand why people talk in this certain way, why things have developed historically in that particular direction. So we're going to be looking at some of these things over the next few months as we do the study period. And so this is all meant to help you to understand this connection with the Dhamma as it's actually lived and understood by Buddhist communities. So there are really three aspects to this question of Dhamma. The first one is Dhamma as what did the Buddha actually teach? And secondly, the Dhamma as it's been taught and understood in time and place by the Buddhist community. And thirdly, and most importantly, of course, how are we to apply the Dhamma here and now in our own lives? And so the first two aspects of that are not meant to be an end in themselves, but they're meant to be useful insofar as they can inform and shape the way that we apply Dhamma in our lives in the here and now. So this is the Dhamma as a refuge, and finally the Sangha as a refuge. And of course the Buddha, after teaching the Dhamma, had those who would penetrate to and understand the Dhamma. So this is the essential aspect of the Sangha as a refuge, is that it's not merely the case that the Buddha, through some kind of special quality that he had alone, was able to realize the Dhamma, but that the nature of the Dhamma and the way that he taught it makes the penetration to the truth available to everyone. And this has actually happened as a reality in history. Now, the Sangha, as the enlightened Sangha, the Arya Sangha, is the Sangha of those who have listened to the Dhamma which the Buddha taught and who have penetrated the Dhamma as reality and as the natural truth. This is what we call the Arya Sangha. So this is, in a sense, this is something which should give us great faith and great hope that there really is something to this, that it is possible to really realize the nature of the Dhamma and the nature of the truth. It's not something which is just locked away as legends and tales of the past. It's a living reality. And the Buddha said that as long as there are people practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, then the world will not lack for arahants. So this is something very, very important to bear in mind. As long as there are people actually practicing the Eightfold Path, then there will be arahants in the world. So this aspect of the Noble Sangha, of course, we never really know who it is, right? So we can have faith, we can think, oh, Ajahn Mun was an arahant or something like that, Ajahn Chah was an arahant, something, and this is an act of faith, but we don't really know. And the Buddha said that there's no real point in somebody at a low level of spiritual development to try to assess or judge somebody at a much higher level of spiritual development. So I've long ago given up the game of speculating about who's got what and who's on this particular level, and this one's a stream enter, and this one's an arahant, and so on, and it's all a bit of a waste of time. But what I can do is I can see what is a person's behavior, what is a person's speech, and I can see whether that behavior and that speech is in conformity with the behavior and speech which the Buddha said is characteristic of a noble one and of an arahant. And so when we see this, then we should be inspired and we should try to emulate it. So this, I think, is the most important thing. And Sangha also, of course, has these two aspects, just as Dhamma has the aspect, the higher aspect of Dhamma is the truth of nature, and the lower aspect as the scriptural texts which describe that truth of nature. And similarly, Sangha has two aspects. The higher Sangha is the noble Sangha of enlightened beings, and the lower aspect of Sangha is the monastic Sangha. And just as the scriptural Dhamma is maybe less profound than the Dhamma of the truth of nature, but much more accessible. Similarly, the lower form of the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, is not as profound or as inspiring as the notion of enlightened beings walking this earth, but is more obvious and more accessible. So, staying here in monastery, we are supporting the development of the monastic Sangha, those who wish to live their life in accordance with the Vinaya. And we're doing that because I have the belief that this path and this monastic lifestyle is actually still, will lead and can lead to enlightenment. And so this is like the union of these things, as the phrase of the Oka robe is said to be the banner of the arahants. And so in that sense, the conventional Sangha and the Sangha in the ultimate sense, or in the highest sense, spiritual Sangha, becomes unified. And so in this sense, the Sangha is also a refuge. So in each case, the meaning of a refuge is somewhere that's a place of shelter and safety from the uncertainties and dangers of the world. And the use of it in this particular context harks back to the very, very ancient and seemingly universal notion that a sacred place should be a place of safety and of refuge. And so we see in the ancient mythologies and in the belief systems of, it seems, all peoples at all times, that when there is violence and danger threatened in a time of war, that people will take refuge in a shrine or in a temple, and that once they are there, that they're in a sense under the protection of the gods, And so one of the worst kinds of war crimes that can be committed is that of actually killing people in a temple, whether this be the behavior of the Greek soldiers in Troy who took some of the women from the temple where they had taken refuge and raped them and killed them, or whether it be the behavior of people in modern times. And a few years ago, for example, the Thai army shot on people who were taking shelter in a mosque in southern Thailand. And again, this was an act that was considered to be particularly outrageous. So this is that idea. And the Buddha pointed out, of course, that this kind of refuge was only was not all that secure, as these examples have shown, that there's a convention that you don't hurt people when they take that refuge, but actually you still can't escape from suffering and death, no matter how much you take refuge in shrines and temples. And so this is that notion of the sarana, the notion of the refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, as being like a true refuge, a spiritual refuge. It's a spiritualizing of that more conventional form of refuge in a physical sense. So the important thing about the notion of refuge is that one has, in a sense, dedicated oneself for these things, and it's an orientation of one's life, so that in a sense there's a sense of commitment and almost submission to these things, that one's not an agnostic anymore. You're not sitting on the fence. You're not saying, I think that the Buddha had some interesting things to say, but he was pretty stuffed up in his attitudes about women, and I don't really think, I think he was deluded in believing that there was heaven and hell and things like that. So if you're sort of sitting on the fence, and it's one thing to be saying that there may be criticism of the Buddha's texts, which of course are subject to editorial interpolations and so on, and so may include many different points of view. But if we're really convinced that the Buddha himself was deluded, then we can't be really said to have taken refuge. And I remember one time I was having an argument about this with a fellow monk who's subsequently disrobed, and we had travelled down to Bangkok together to visit my teacher, Ajahn Maha Chachai. And we were sitting in the Dhamma hall there having a discussion, and I sort of found out to my surprise that this monk really didn't believe in rebirth, didn't believe in heaven and hell and so on, and thought this was all a load of baloney. And he'd been a friend of mine since he'd ordained as a monk. We'd been close together and known each other well, and I had never had any idea that he'd been so skeptical. And we were kind of discussing these things, and he thought, as I just said, he thought that the Buddha was deluded and subject to his cultural conditioning and so on, and that even though the teachings on mindfulness and so on were useful, but that the Buddha's actual cosmology and understanding of the world was essentially delusory. And I was kind of in a bit of shock about this, and interestingly enough, that at that moment, Ajahn Maha Chachai walked into the room, not able to hear any of our conversation. And then it was a very, very unusual occasion. If any of you had the chance to meet Ajahn Chachai, then one of the things that is very characteristic of him is that he's very unhurried and takes quite a long time to get to know somebody and to become comfortable with somebody before starting on teaching the Dhamma. And so very normally when I'm sitting down with him, we'll talk about how our life's been or incidental events and so on, and then gradually work our way around to discussing the meditation and so on. And so this was the only time I've seen him where he walked in, and immediately, without any preamble or anything whatsoever, he started talking about the profundity of the Buddha's wisdom and his understanding of the nature of the truth. And I was quite shocked, actually, that he was speaking to exactly the issue that we were talking about. And you're most welcome to speculate about why that may be. But in any case, this just gives you an idea of the kind of thing that I'm talking about, that to my sense that monk hadn't really taken refuge. And I would question whether somebody could actually be a monk in that case. I mean, to me it seems if you haven't even taken refuge, then taking an ordination is a fairly meaningless event. And I personally doubt whether somebody like that should actually be considered a bhikkhu. So this is that kind of meaning, and so it doesn't mean that you it means that you have a faith, but it means you have the kind of faith which the Buddha was talking about, which was an inquiring and intelligent faith, not a blind and devotional faith. And so that faith and that trust means that we can ask questions. And I want the people staying here, I want you to see this as being a very real thing. It's not just an idea which we can say as a doctrine. We can say, oh yes, the Buddha, Kalama Sutta, he encouraged inquiry, therefore we're much better than all of those dogmatic Christians who just tell you to believe, right? That's how these teachings often get used in Buddhism. But the actual amount of real inquiry is not all that much. So I want you to take that as a real thing, and then to really have the trust to be able to make those inquiries, okay? No matter how painful and how difficult they are. And that trust is very important. If we have that, then we have that space to be able to ask the difficult questions. We have the space to be able to say, no, I'm not satisfied with that answer. That's just skirting the question. That's just avoidance. What's really going on here? And to be able to pursue that with depth and with intelligence and with compassion, to be able to really get to the heart of the matter. And so this is the attitude that I've tried to use in investigating various kinds of Dhamma issues and problems which have confronted me in my life. And as you know, earlier in my monastic career, I did a lot of research into the question of Samatha and Vipassana. And again, that was because I wasn't satisfied with the simplistic and I felt quite shallow answers that I was often given by the traditions, and I wanted to try and really nut it out and really figure out what was going on and try to pursue that as far as I could. And then more recently, of course, with the researchers into bhikkhunis, and again I wasn't satisfied to just say, well, you know, there are these legal opinions on matters of bhikkhuni ordination procedure, but I really wanted to, and I'm still studying and still trying to find out the real heart of the matter, what's really going on, what's going on underneath the surface. And of course, by doing so, that leads into many very interesting areas and reveals kinds of truth which will never become available to you if you're too easily satisfied with simple answers. And so this is that kind of inquiry, and that depth of inquiry is what I like to encourage and what I like to see. And so that involves like a taking on of a sense of personal responsibility for uncovering the truth, rather than having it all handed to you on a platter. And again, I just want to emphasize again and again that takes place within an environment of trust and of faith. When we have that, then we can undertake those inquiries as deeply and as painfully and as joyfully and as complex or as simple or as profoundly as we can, and it will all come together, it will all cohere in the end. And so sometimes we have to go out on a limb, we have to take some chances, but still having the faith that at the end of the day things will come around. And so this has been very much my experience in investigating some of these questions. For example, the story of Mahapajapati and the refusal of her ordination by the Buddha, and the very disturbing imagery which the text uses at that point. And I've kept on nagging away at this issue for year after year after year, studying and researching and discussing it and dialoguing with people. And gradually I'm still, even now, just really starting to grasp what I think are the implications and the true meaning and context of this particular passage, this particular incident. And so if we have that real feeling of refuge, then that will always guide us through whatever doubts and difficulties that we have and we're able to pursue. So that's a bit of a talk this evening. I was going to talk about the eight precepts, but I think it's probably a bit getting a bit long. So maybe put that off for another time. Anyway, just for now, keep the eight precepts for the New Anagarikas. You've already been keeping them, so you have some good idea of what they are. I might talk about that on another occasion. But I think that's probably enough for now. And I offer that for your reflection and enjoyment. And I'd like to ask if there's any comments or questions. Yeah. We see she's, so the Buddha's mother in the Pali text is just called, sorry, the Buddha's wife in the Pali text is just called Rahula Mata, okay, Rahula's mother. And we find various kinds of names ascribed to her in various traditions and various texts. In some cases she's called Bada, Bada Kachana, Yasodhara, Yasovati, Bimba, Bimba Sundara, Bimba Devi, and so on and so forth. There's about a dozen or more names that she's actually given in various texts at various times. So, and in kind of the interesting or the, so in a way, I mean, I think it's very interesting. She in a sense, she's almost like, she's just a figure. You know, she's not an actual person. We don't really know anything about her as a person. She just appears and plays this role as the Buddha's wife. And like most of the people in the Buddha's life story, they're fairly two-dimensional. And so, but it's interesting, but according to Malalasekara, who wrote the book on the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, he concluded that most likely her original name was Bimba. But Bimba actually just means an image or a puppet, is what a Bimba is. Yeah? So I thought this is very interesting. So the reality is we don't really know what her name is. Yeah. And we don't even know, you know, other facts, like some traditions say the Buddha had only one wife, others say he had three wives. Okay, so maybe we should finish by paying respects.